Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last October, Adam Riess was named one of three U.S.-born scientists to win the Nobel Prize in Physics, along with Saul Perlmutter and U.S.-Australian Brian Schmidt, for the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe through observations of distant exploding stars. This new view of an accelerating universe has been compared to Galileo's revolutionary discoveries four centuries ago, changing physics and philosophy forever. Joining us now is Nobel laureate Adam Riess. He is professor of astronomy and physics at the Johns Hopkins University, and he's also a senior member of the science staff at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. He will be speaking at the OSU Department of Physics this evening. We'll post a link on our website for more information. Go to wosu.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
You shared the Nobel Prize with two others, including Saul Perlmutter, who headed the competing research team. This was good that there was competition.
That's right. That's right. Competition in science is very good because rather than there being one winner, sort of we all win, because in science, we really like to see reproducibility of results. And so if one team had just, quote, won by making this discovery alone, then in reality, probably most of the community would not have believed it because it was such a surprising, really shocking result. So the fact that you had two teams competing and doing the experiment independently, both ultimately getting the same answer, was very important.
You were getting the same answer. Were you looking at the same stars?
No, we were looking at different stars. That's the beautiful thing, again, about the universe, is anybody with the right equipment and understanding should be able to go out and look at these exploding stars and come to the same conclusion.
The ability to do this sort of started with a woman scientist who didn't have access to telescopes back in the 20s, I guess, or something. But she started to measure or realized you could measure the brightness of the stars and measure distance that way.
Right. So Henrietta Leavitt was measuring these. Her stars were not exploding.
Right.
They were actually pulsating. But there's a lot of commonality there, and it's the brightness of the star, which tells you how far away it is, as long as you understand how luminous it is. And so she came up with a way to understand how luminous they were in the same way that we use these supernovae to measure distances in the universe. The difference is these supernovae are so much brighter. They're about as bright as 4 billion suns for a short period of time, which just means that we can see them further out than Henrietta could.
When you're looking at them like that, what are you seeing? Is it like a, what does it
right.
look like?
It, you know, what we are actually seeing usually is a galaxy that may have 10 or 100 billion stars, but because the galaxy is far away, we don't see any individual star. I guess I would compare it to when you listen to a crowd, you just hear the kind of roar of all the voices. But every once in a while, if you've ever had that experience where suddenly, for some reason, something gets quiet for a moment, you just hear that one voice, whatever it says. When a supernova goes off, it's sort of like hearing that one voice above the crowd, but it's incredibly bright, as I said, as bright as 4 billion stars. And so for us, that we can pick out that one voice, that one star, makes it a great tool.
And being able to see that far away, it's a series of telescopes. How are you physically able to see that far away?
Right. Well, you have to use the most powerful telescopes to see the furthest away. So in recent years, that's generally been the Hubble Space Telescope we've used. Now, Hubble can also observe nearby supernovae as well. But the way it works in astronomy, usually you use the smallest telescope that's still capable of observing what you want to observe, because those telescopes, the great ones, are in high demand. So we would use smaller telescopes to observe the nearby supernovae and successively more powerful ones for the further away.
My guest is Nobel laureate Adam Riess. He's a professor of astronomy and physics at Johns Hopkins University. If you have a question or comment for Adam, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You learned about the accelerated expansion of the universe by studying the exploding stars, but you weren't looking for it. You expected to find something exactly the opposite.
That's right. That's right. So we've known for a long time that the universe is expanding, but the expectation was that that expansion, which began after the Big Bang, would be slowing down, that all the objects in the universe, their attractive gravity, would pull back and slow the expansion. And the big question was, is it slowing enough to stop the expansion and cause the universe to start contracting and end in sort of the opposite of the Big Bang? Or is the universe expanding only very modestly and we could actually figure out that it would expand forever? So we set out to measure how fast the or how much the expansion was slowing down. And we were shocked to find that it, not only is it not slowing down, it is actually speeding up. And that could not be explained by the normal attractive kind of gravity that we're familiar with, but rather seems to require a more exotic, I would say repulsive gravity, something that Einstein had first predicted could be true back in 1917 when he developed his general theory of relativity.
Right. That is the constant, the cosmological
right.
constant.
So he called it the cosmological constant in a desperate attempt to explain how the universe could be not expanding. That was 10 years before we saw that it was expanding. Today, we would call his cosmological constant one of a broader category of types of material that we call dark energy.
I loved it. I think you told Ira Flatow on Science Friday last year that that goes to show you that even blunders for Einstein are still pretty good days for the rest of
us. That's right. That's right.
True genius. So the acceleration also, it was interesting to find, and correct me, of course, if I'm wrong, but it's not necessarily uniform. You're not sure that it is.
Right. It is difficult to determine to high precision if it's uniform, and that would be potentially a way to learn more about it. Right now, our precision is pretty crude, and so it looks uniform-ish, but we would have to make much better measurements, and we plan to in the future, to see if there are departures in different directions of the sky.
So measurements since the discovery also have confirmed that about 70% of the universe consists of anti-gravitational dark energy, and another 25% is dark matter. But we still don't know what that is. We call it dark because we can't see it. So I'm trying to get my arms around what's the difference between dark energy and dark matter if we can't see it?
Right. That's a good question. Well, first off, dark matter seems to be attractive. And so it seems like it has gravity, just like ordinary matter has gravity. It's just something that doesn't emit light. So, for example, planets, which are not close enough to a star to reflect a lot of light, would not emit light. You wouldn't see them. You would call them dark matter. Anything that doesn't have a light source, but still is matter and has gravity, would be dark matter. We also mostly see dark matter living in galaxies or in clusters of galaxies in similar environments that regular luminous matter like stars live. Dark energy seems to live everywhere, and most interestingly, even between the galaxies. And rather than having attractive gravity, it actually has repulsive gravity. It seems to be smoothly distributed, whereas the matter is very choppy and clumpy. So they actually act quite differently. The unifying principles between them is neither of them emit light, and both of them we infer by their gravity. But after that, they're completely different. They live in different places. They have different kinds of gravity. One seems to be smooth. One seems to be clumpy. And so we believe at this point we need to actually discover each of them on their own.
As far as the dark matter goes, you said it's often found in galaxies around other luminous matter. So if there's other luminous matter, it's not that it isn't near something that it can reflect. It's that it doesn't reflect, whether it's near something luminous or not.
Right. Well, even within a galaxy, is mostly empty space. And so when I say that there's dark matter in the galaxy, I don't necessarily mean the dark matter is hovered around stars.
Okay.
It's just somewhere in the galaxy. What we actually believe today is that the dark matter is a kind of particle, often referred to as a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. And that there's kind of a sea of these WIMPs that fills our galaxy, fills clusters of galaxies. but that they don't have any primary interactions with matter. And so it's very difficult to actually detect them directly. They don't emit light. They just have mass and seem to interact gravitationally. But there's a hope that in the new Large Hadron Collider, which has been running for about 2 years now in France and Switzerland, that we might be able to actually create and see these WIMPs and discover the dark matter that way.
My guest is Nobel laureate Adam Riess, professor of astronomy and physics at Johns Hopkins University. He was named last October one of three U.S.-born scientists to win the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and put your question or comment there. It's hard to imagine that right here in our own backyard of history, that our ideas about the universe have been revolutionized. And I wonder, do you get up every morning now and go, wow, what have we turned on its ear today? I mean, what is it a domino effect where it starts to affect theories about lots of other things? Or how does it affect schools of thought?
Right. Well, when you have a discovery like this, it is hard to know where it will go. I mean, you know that, at least I realize, it's not a detail about the universe. It actually is most of the universe, as you said, about 70%. And so all of our theories and everything in the universe has to make room for this. And so it has caused people to go back and try to understand every aspect of our study of the universe, cosmology and astronomy. How do galaxies respond to this dark energy? How do clusters of galaxies respond? How has it affected the age of the universe? How does it affect the way the dynamics of the universe unfurl? What does it say about the ultimate fate of the universe? And so we have to go back to all those areas, as well as particle physics. What does this say about the vacuum of space? What does this say about the nature of gravity? Does this actually fit in Einstein's understanding of gravity, or is there another revolution afoot? Is there some brilliant idea which would connect dark matter and dark energy to tell us that they are, you know, opposite sides of a coin? I mean, it doesn't look like that, but, you know, it makes you step back and sort of rethink all the areas that we thought we had nicely sewed up.
So has it sort of created these cottage industries out there of people now taking a left turn on what they maybe have been going in one direction and stopped and turned and went into another direction?
Well, I think it has. There are a lot of people who now are studying dark energy. When I go to the online journals, you know, there's a new paper, I would say about three or four new papers every day, either trying to study dark energy, trying to hypothesize what it might be or how it might connect to or relate to other mysteries in the universe. And so it's very exciting to sort of see how that's going, and I really look forward to watching how it turns out. I mean, some discoveries, you discover something and people might say, yeah, okay, that was what we expected, and there's nothing else to know about it. But in this case, it has really created way more questions than we've answered.
My guest again, Nobel laureate Adam Riess. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, has the 401k failed as a retirement plan for the American public? A lot of account balances say yes, it has. We'll investigate. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 56 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Expect sunny skies for most of the day and a high of 66. Clear skies tonight, a low of 43 degrees. Sunshine for Friday, a high of 72. More sunshine on Saturday, a high of 76.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Nobel laureate Adam Riess. He's a professor of astronomy and physics at Johns Hopkins University. He's also one of three U.S.-born scientists who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics last October. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Andrew from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Ian. Love the show. Listen every day that I can.
Thank you.
I actually just had a question. What is a Bose-Higgins particle? I've heard of this a few times in relation to maybe like an atom or something like that.
Maybe you mean a Higgs boson?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's all right. Well, it's pretty far afield from the things we're actually looking at, but it's a hypothetical particle that's predicted from the theories of particle physics that is the particle that gives other particles their mass. It's thought to be that there's kind of a sea of these Higgs bosons spread throughout space. And as other particles try to move through space, almost the way you would try to move through like hip-deep water in a lake, that that sort of friction that's caused by or the difficulty of moving is what those interactions are what actually give particles their mass.
Thank you so much. Awesome show.
Thanks, Andrew. You've said that you hope by generating these discoveries, you'll inspire the next Einstein, maybe, who will put the pieces together. And you said that observations alone aren't enough, that it really requires a kind of theoretical synthesis. Tell me what you mean by that. I mean, I understand what synthesis means, but where might that come from and how might it emerge?
Right. Well, sometimes observations give us very blunt tools for understanding the universe. It's a little bit like that childhood game of when you're looking for something and somebody's telling you warmer, colder as you move around the room looking for it. I feel often that we're in that situation, that our observations have pointed us in general directions, but we can't, through pure observation, come up with an elegant theory like Einstein's theory of relativity. Rather, I think we collect clues, and if we're really successful, we inspire the brightest minds to recognize that this is really the deepest, most fundamental mystery of the universe. And like any time the sword is sort of cast in the stone in a sort of King Arthur sense, it brings out the greatest to really focus their minds on that problem. And so I think we're getting pretty close to that point where this one's ripe, and we're waiting while we collect clues for that great idea.
Do you see yourself as just a clue collector or maybe someone who could come up with that synthesis?
Right. No, I'm a clue collector. I would love to be the person who comes up with the synthesis. But, you know, everybody has their role to play in this story. And, you know, it's such a fantastic story, the discovery of the universe in general, that I'm happy to play any role in it. And, you know, you go to where your strengths are. I'm very good at collecting clues. And I do go to conferences and talk to the people who have the capability to synthesize it all. And I may try to say, you know, you should really look hard at this clue. I think, you know, this one's robust and important. Or, you know, this one may not be, I'm not even sure if it's right, you know. And so you work with them. You definitely do. Or the best is if they come back to you and say, hey, I have an idea. Why don't you try this experiment? Why don't you look for this? Because that would help me understand what's going on. So there's a give and take between what I call experiment and observation versus theory.
You know, we were talking earlier before the show about, I asked you, did you graduate from high school when you were two? And I was joking. We were talking about what is a really, really smart person? And you were saying not necessarily a really, really smart person is going to be someone in your position. Not that you're not really, really smart.
Right. It's surprising that I'm not that smart. But in reality, what has surprised me about science to make contributions in science, I would have thought 20 years ago that it was always just the very smartest person, the kid in the class who could raise their hand for every single question, was the one who would make contributions. But in reality, what has surprised me is science is very entrepreneurial. You have an idea, you need to do an experiment, you need to get funds, you need to communicate the ideas. You need to convince people. You need to be creative about how you'll solve problems. You need to be able to work well with people, manage people in some cases, have persistence, have drive, all characteristics that are not just purely, you know, rocket scientist sort of brilliance. And so I think I guess I mean this especially to the people out there who love science and are think that they're pretty good at it, that there's so many more areas that that are helpful and valuable to make contributions, that that can often be the key, is to be, I would say, pretty good in a broad range of skills rather than just off scale in one.
And curiosity.
Oh, curiosity. I mean, you really can't be a scientist without curiosity.
You know, when you talk about entrepreneur science as being successful, as if you're more entrepreneurial, there is a movement, a trend at universities now to be more entrepreneurial with their science and to commercialize it more in order to fund it instead of just with tuition dollars or grants from the government and that sort of thing, maybe get more involved at a commercial level. How do you feel about that? Do you think what you do would have occurred if there would have been a corporation involved or something like that?
I don't think so. I think science is entrepreneurial in the sense that when you have an idea and you want to do an experiment, let's say, it's like a startup business. And so you might need to go out and get funding and organize it in that same way. But at the end, instead of explaining how your idea is going to make a lot of money, that may not be the metric. It maybe that this is an experiment which could teach us something very valuable about the universe. And so my concern would be you go to corporations with that story and they may not be that enthusiastic. Learning about the universe is great, but how do we make some money off this?
Because they answer to shareholders.
Right. That's right. And so it's, you know, at the end of the day, the metric by which you value success for this kind of startup business is going to be very different. And so the people who would want to invest in it would be very different. It would be people with a very long-term interest, the realization that when we do basic R&D research, we learn about the universe. And yes, usually there are products that spin off of that. There always have been. You know, most of the technology we have, our iPhones and various gizmos, our lasers for our CD and DVD players, all these things came out of basic research many decades ago. But the funding structure of a corporation usually asks that those products can be predicted to come out, let's say, in the next fiscal year. And that is not a framework in which science operates very well.
So you have to be disappointed then that the United States has pretty much abandoned its space program and it's becoming privatized now, or we're relying on the Russians for access.
Right. Well, you know, in terms of the space program, I mean, this is the part of the space program that involves putting people in space.
Right.
And that side is usually referred to as exploration. And exploration often can be funded, I think, in a commercial sense. I mean, the explorers who came over in the 14 and 1500s to the United States were funded because it was thought that not just that they would discover new worlds, but that they would bring back, you know, spices and treasures. In our case, science is a somewhat different investigation than exploration. Sometimes we piggyback on exploration, but mostly we drive our experiments by our ability to learn about the universe. And those are areas that I don't think have been ripe for or are even being speculated as being led by corporations.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Yes, I was wondering about the thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering about if the 3 degrees Kelvin measurement by Penzias and I think it's Wilson has that much to do with the dark energy, and could dark energy or this or either of these, the 3 degrees, the dark energy, be created by anything else besides the alleged Big Bang?
Right, that's a great question. Of course, the 3 degree radiation is the little bit of heat left over from the Big Bang, which was first seen in 1968 by Penzias and Wilson. That was right. They won the Nobel Prize for that. And that has been seen now many times to much greater detail with other observatories. But this is one of the key pieces of evidence that something like the Big Bang Theory is correct, that the universe started as a singularity and expanded and was hot and dense and is now cool and diffuse. And dark energy fits very well into that framework. That explains why the universe is accelerating now and was not accelerating then, because the universe was much denser in the past. And so at that time, the attractive gravity would have won out over this repulsive gravity. And so when we try to understand these aspects of the universe today, these components, dark energy and dark matter, we do that within the framework of the Big Bang. And so we rest on the observational clues that were collected in the past. I can't think of another way, really, to generate that kind of three-degree background without the Big Bang. There used to be a competitor to the Big Bang theory in the 1950s and 60s called the steady-state theory, which hypothesized that the universe was expanding but that there was no Big Bang. That theory predicted that there would be no three-degree or any background radiation. And in fact, seeing that background radiation was one of the key tests between those two theories. And I think, you know, now for 30, 40 years, we've been on the Big Bang theory track until somebody comes up with a different idea that explains what we see. I think that's going to be with us to stay.
Thanks, Don, for your call. If you're just joining us, my guest is Adam Riess. He's one of three U.S.-born scientists to win the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe. You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have a question for him. Richard in Buckeye Lake, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi. Richard Feinstein described a universe in which, as far as I could tell, particles were popping into existence and then disappearing. If dark energy is uniform, could that be the underpinnings or the beginning of a description?
Yes. In fact, it's tempting just to say yes and leave it at that, because that is actually the best starting guess we have. It may or may not be right, but exactly as you said, Richard Feynman and other physicists of his generation explained how there must be really these virtual particles that appear and disappear in the vacuum of space, that in order not to violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that has to happen. And then you combine that with Einstein's explanation of gravity, that kind of energy from those virtual particles would produce something very much like what we call dark energy. So I wanted to say yes, because that's a great story and that fits everything that we understand and see. The only problem is that when we try to calculate the answer to that theoretically, we get a number that's about 120 orders of magnitude too large for what we see. So there's something still we don't understand in that picture to bring together that theoretical idea, which you suggested, and the observations that we see. But we think there's something to that story. And I would say today that is still our best guess about what causes dark energy.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you, Richard. 614-292-8513, once again, is the number. My guest, Nobel laureate Adam Riess, will be with us for another 5 minutes or so. So get the calls in right away if you're interested. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I have a quick question for Mr. Riess. I was just wondering if he was excited about the recent news about MIT and Harvard and the Udacity program offering all their courses online for free, and the rest of the universities around the world jumping on that. Is that going to raise the collective intelligence of the world? I think it will. I think it's an awesome thing. And I'll hang up for the answer. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Mike.
Yes, I'm excited about it, too. Actually, those are my two alma maters. And I think it's great. I kind of picture somebody, you know, who maybe couldn't afford to go to school or couldn't take the time to, but, you know, going home each night and studying these courses and learning everything that we know. And maybe at the end of the day, they'll come out with a great idea to teach us what dark energy is, or maybe they'll just have fun learning about the universe. I think it's really great. I'm interested to know how things go after that. I think it could be a major change in the way that we deliver education. I don't know if it will interact or interconnect with the university system of people actually being on site and interacting with students and teachers. I think that's an important element of education, but it's not the only important element. So I think it's wonderful.
For many years, you've been teaching a course at Johns Hopkins University called Great Discoveries in Astronomy and Astrophysics for non-majors. And right. I was wondering, what do you get out of that, and what do you think they get out of it?
Sometimes I think I get it helps me retain my mental sanity. When you do research every day, research is hard. It's frustrating. Research, by definition, means you're working on something that nobody's ever done before or was able to do. Usually you could find a literature of people who have worked on it. And so you spend a few hours banging your head against the wall, and then you get to walk into this classroom where you get to sort of sprinkle around the results of successful research over hundreds of years. It's like throwing candy out. You get to tell the students about all the great things that we know, all the research projects that turned out well. So I feel like it helps me maintain my mental equilibrium.
Ed in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Oh, hi, Ann. Adam, I had an idea about why the universe is expanding as accelerating as it expands. I kind of think of it as like dropping a liquid on a plate. As it expands, the universe gets thinner as far as its ability to hold itself together. And as it becomes thinner and thinner, it accelerates. That's the idea.
Right. That's an interesting idea. Usually it is challenging to evaluate ideas like that unless we do a little more mathematics and try to put it into a framework where we can make predictions based on that idea. I'm sort of scanning my brain and thinking it doesn't automatically resonate or match with any of the ideas that we have now. I think we haven't seen that kind of property of the universe, that sort of thinning and decreasing. But thank you for sharing it.
Thank you, Ed. An email from Robert. He writes, I am not a scientist, but my undergraduate studies were in science education, and I still apply those studies in what I do in environmental policy analysis. One of my frustrations is when some natural scientists place so much emphasis on the empirical and experimental aspects of scientific method that they greatly downplay the need for the development of hypotheses that the empirical experiments are designed to test. Hypotheses that are, to a large extent, based on deductive reasoning. Can you comment on my frustration and try to explain the great need in making scientific progress in both inductive and deductive logic in science?
Well, I don't know. I my experience is that they go hand in hand. Being the empiricist, I am often desperate to get more hypotheses. I happen to work in a field, an area of dark energy, where unfortunately we're really struggling to come up with good hypotheses. I can only say it's been my experience that we welcome them with open arms. They provide the targets, if you will, for us to shoot at and try to figure out what's going on in the universe. I don't know ultimately if we can learn about the universe by laying down every possible hypothesis and by the process of elimination get to the right one simply that way. But I think it's a very hand-in-hand sort of process.
Well, Adam Reese, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nobel laureate Adam Reese, professor of astronomy and physics at Johns Hopkins University. He will be speaking tonight at OSU. For more information on that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to talk about the president's announcement yesterday in an interview that he now supports gay marriage. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of young adult fiction. Join us and a few authors who are guests at the Ohioana Book Festival for All Sides from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And many of our members have discovered the advantages of using the WOSU member card for two-for-one dining, cultural events, and family activities. The member card benefit of the month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy two-for-one admission all month long. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org right now. And thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 57 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine, a sunny day today with a high of 66. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 47 degrees. More sunshine for Friday, another nice day, a high of 72. Clear skies Friday night, a low of 51. And sunshine for Saturday, a high of 76. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
President Obama announced his support for same-sex marriage yesterday in an interview with ABC's Robin Roberts.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
That news ranked in the Columbus Dispatch right up there with the announcement that Columbus had made a pitch for a pro basketball team this morning. And the Twitter sphere, not to mention the blogosphere and any other news operation, was a whirling dervish of reaction all afternoon and night. Joining us now to weigh the politics of the news is retired Dayton Daily News correspondent Bill Hershey. Bill's covered politics at the state and national level for many years. He's a regular guest on All Sides and also WOSU's Columbus on the Record. Question for our listeners, will the announcement, do you believe, help or hurt the president's reelection effort? This isn't a question about gay marriage. This is whether his announcement will help or hurt his reelection effort. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Bill Hershey, president, faces considerable risk in jumping into this debate, some think. Whether or not, you know, whether or not he does it reluctantly or not. I didn't get the sense that he is very reluctant about this, though.
He seemed to have made a definite decision on this, but I think it was almost inevitable, particularly after Vice President Biden on Sunday. It seems like he got ahead of himself and said that he was totally comfortable with same-sex marriage. The president would have looked wishy-washy, and he would have been blasted for that. However, I don't know if they can calculate that this is a plus or not, because I think we have a new poll out today by Quinnipiac that shows Ohio is a dead heat, 45% to 44%. Neither he nor Governor Romney has an advantage, and particularly an incumbent president who's below 50% at this point. Maybe he doesn't think that he could lose by doing this, but there are ways he could lose with African-American voters who are his key constituency for him. Previous polling has shown there's no great support for same-sex marriage among these voters. But it's all about the numbers. The national polling shows that independents, who are important in Ohio, support same-sex marriage. So this is a fascinating development.
As far as Vice President Biden goes, some have theorized that he was more like the canary in the coal mine. It wasn't an accident that he raised the issue the way he did.
I've thought about it both ways. He has a tendency sometimes to get ahead of himself and say things that maybe he shouldn't. On the other hand, the Obama administration is pretty calculating about what it does. So the canary in the coal mine scenario could be the correct one.
Peggy in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Hi. I think ultimately this is going to help Obama. If we want to say when the dust settles, I don't know if it is unsettled right now or if it's settling. I'm not really sure. But, you know, when I heard the news, I just said, you know, tomorrow the sun is going to shine. The stock market is not going to plummet. You know, unemployment is probably going to be where it's at. You know, this choice to come forward and make this statement, I don't think is going to affect most people's opinions ultimately on where they stand on Obama. I think if they weren't going to vote for him, they weren't going to vote for him. And I don't think this ultimately is going to change their mind in the end.
Do you think it might get out even a small fraction of the vote that might have just sat back, particularly among people who are disappointed in his lack of activity in the gay rights front?
I do, because I think some people were kind of just sitting on the sidelines, disappointed with how he has handled some things. And I think they've been motivated. They've been inspired now to get more involved. I think they've all kind of exhaled and said, you know, okay, this is good sign. This is something that's going to motivate me. So I think that for all the people who are going to be inspired by what happened, I think that number is going to be far greater than the number of people that may, you know, drop off of being a Obama supporter. So I think it's, in the end, I think this is good news for the country.
All right, Peggy, thank you.
Thank you.
No matter what, it is historical. He's the first sitting president, end of story.
No president has done this before. And he has been criticized, I think, as you said, or maybe the caller said, for being kind of wishy-washy on things. He was the president of hope in 2008, and a lot of those hopes have been dashed or unfulfilled by people. And this is supposed to be, he mentioned it himself, appealing to younger voters or younger people. He said that his own daughters couldn't imagine that gay couples who are raising children would be treated any differently than straight couples, I guess. So it is a historical moment, but it's also a political moment. We look at this polling data again. Democrats overwhelmingly for this, nearly two-thirds. Independents, nearly 60%, but Republicans, just 22%. He wasn't going to get the votes of any of these Republicans, or many of those Republicans anyway. So he rolled the dice here. Maybe he would pick up a few suburban Republican votes this way.
GOP challenger Mitt Romney quickly uttered the flip-flop phrase. I don't know if you noticed that. And I wondered,
yes,
do you think that applies in the issue of gay marriage? Just because it seems like when you look at the polling just since 1996, when they really started polling seriously on it, it's been a moving target, and it's always moving in the same direction.
And he said his views are evolving. I thought it was interesting that Mitt Romney called the president a flip-flopper. I don't know what the cliche would be about the flip-flopper,
the
flipping, or calling the pot calling the flipper a flip-flopper.
Another flipper calling,
yes,
someone a flip-flop. Because...
Well, Governor Romney previously had supported some... tried to garner support on the gay issue when he ran for governor of Massachusetts. He's changed his position on abortion, another hot-button social issue. So I'm not sure, but I don't think this will be the premier issue for many voters. I think the Quinnipiac polling showed that some 40%, fewer than half, said that these social issues were a big thing to them. But we know that a percentage or two wins in Ohio. In 2004, issue one on the ballot, banning a same-sex marriage, won by more than 60% of the vote. That helped President Bush, and he carried the state by less than 2% against John Kerry. So we're talking about small percentages that could mean a lot in the outcome.
My guest is Bill Hershey, retired Dayton Daily News correspondent. We're talking about the president's announcement in an interview yesterday with ABC Television that he now supports gay marriage rights. If you have what we'd like to know is, what kind of impact do you think that might have on his race for reelection? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. As I said earlier, the American public's been evolving rapidly on the issue. In April, for the first time, the Pew Research Center found that more Americans supported than opposed gay marriage. Just 3 years earlier, opponents led by 11 points. That's a huge switch on anything.
It seems to be moving rapidly,
as
the change.
grow up and become 18 years old and start their voices start to matter is what it seems like.
Yes, and I think your point's a good one. The demographics of this is significant. Younger voters, what's the big deal? Why can't same-sex couples get married? And the it seems like it has a snowball effect almost.
Hmm. Keith in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Hi.
Hi.
Just watching the show, nice delivery of the topic on both sides. Directly, I want to say all politicians will be flip-floppers until Americans do their civic duty and learn how to vote with their heads instead of a one item. Obama flip-flop, his opponent flip-flops. I think this will hurt in the long run. That in a nutshell.
Because he's changed his mind, you're of the idea that politicians shouldn't change their mind on anything? Or
Every election, they cater to the current trend. And my I guess I'm wording this poorly, until the average American takes the time to really inform themselves of the issues instead of pandering to one side. Candidly speaking, my mother's side all votes Democratic. My father's side all vote Republican, and they never look at the issues. They pick one topic and stick to it, and I think in the long run that's what's hurting this country and why, forgive me, we're going socialist.
Okay. All right. Bill Hershey, thanks, Keith.
Thanks for your time.
Well, I don't know if we're going socialist or not. That's certainly what some of the opponents of President Obama think. But I thought one thing that we might add to this discussion, imitation is the highest form of flattery. Mm-hmm. And we know that opponents of gay same-sex marriage in 2004 were successful in getting people to the ballot to vote for President Bush. And I'm wondering if this effort to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot this year to allow same-sex marriage would do the same thing, particularly in light of what the president said. I know the backers of this amendment have to gather more than 380,000 signatures.
But that won't put it on the ballot this year, will it?
It's it next year?
Yeah, it's next year anyway.
So they won't have any impetus for getting to the polls this year, other than the president's support for this issue. I think you're right.
Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks. Just quickly, I think it's too soon to tell whether it'll help or hurt them. I think it probably will help them with independence. But what I heard you say earlier was a comment about how there are those who feel that he hasn't done enough and that he's been lackadaisical in his support. And I want to correct that because I think that is a misstatement. I mean, he led the fight against the repeal for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He has directed his attorney general not to defend the federal DOMA statute. I mean, what more could a president do?
Oh, well, that's I understand what you're saying. I was just parroting, frankly, what others have said. That
sure.
I
know it wasn't your opinion, but I'm hearing it again and again, and I think we need to answer that and say, hold on a minute. As president, he's done everything he can do. And now this is the last step.
Well, Tom, how do you feel about what he said, though, yesterday as well? He qualified it. He said he thinks gay marriage is fine, same-sex marriage is fine, but he also thinks that it should continue the way it is on a state-by-state basis in terms of doling out the rights to it.
Well, I'm sure your guest will appreciate that. I think the best we can say about politics is that it's the art of what's possible. And realistically, we can't be naive. We can't always get everything we want right away, and things happen in increments. The worst we can say about politics is it's a dirty business, and sometimes politicians have to do things incrementally to achieve the ultimate goal. So I understand that criticism, but I also am not naive politically.
Okay. Tom, thanks for your call.
Great, thanks.
The art of the possible.
And I think that you made a good point. This is a state issue. It's state by state, but it has national implications symbolically. And that's the difference between the real and the symbolic. And they sort of converge.
You know, I don't know if it was, once again, are these coincidences or not, but the day before he announced his position, in other words, on Tuesday, voters in North Carolina, a critical state for the president and also the site of the Democratic National Convention this summer, approved by a 20-point margin a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage in that state.
And that's a battleground state, as you said. And that's one of the southern states the president won and hope to win again. And I, this, of course, every election is different. An election this month is different than the presidential election, when more voters will turn out. But it certainly wasn't a positive trend for the president's point of view.
Again, the polling shows is in one direction now all the time. It's changing. But in the black community, I wasn't able to find any breakout that way for it. And I wondered if you knew whether it's changed in the black community or not.
I hadn't been either.
And even if it hasn't, when it comes to statistically, how critical is that vote?
That's critical to President Obama because that was, you know, the cornerstone of
that
his.
That was the 1 or 2%. Yeah.
He gets overwhelming support there. And I think black pastors have spoken against same-sex marriage, and this is a key part of the African-American community. But what the pastors say doesn't always mean that the people in the pews will follow their views either. And you wonder if these voters are going to vote for Mitt Romney, whom they disagree with on most every other issue.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. We've been talking about the president's decision yesterday to announce that he has changed his mind about same-sex marriage. He thinks it should be a right now, but we'll hold back and not push it on the states and let the states decide for themselves. Right now, 31 states, when you count North Carolina, I believe, have passed amendments like that, constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. So time will tell. Bill Hershey, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Hershey, retired Dayton Daily News correspondent, covered state and national politics. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.